Hi, and welcome to the River Talk Podcast, a podcast where we talk about whitewater stuff, rafting, kayaking, whatever we feel like, hosted by Eric Weiseth, Priscilla Macy, and me, Zach Collier. Eric might be joining us partway through. He's in a meeting, but Priscilla and I are here. How you doing, Priscilla?
I'm doing okay. A little chilly here in the Willamette Valley, but yeah. Doing good.
It's funny, all summer I think about how I'm going to go boating in the fall when it rains. And then it rains and it's really cold out and it takes a lot of motivation to actually go out in that cold sometimes.
Yeah. I'm not, as I get older, I guess I'm much less of a fan of cold weather. I'd rather just stay inside with my little heater. But yeah, hopefully before we get some higher elevation snow, we'll be able to enjoy some of the runs that might be more inaccessible in winter and in early spring. So I'm excited to try to spend some time on the Coast Range around here that seems like it should get some precipitation this weekend.
Yeah, we got rain coming to Oregon and it looks like Washington and all over the place. So it's definitely boating season is beginning for all those hardcore winter boaters.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and the Smith is supposed to get a Smith and the Illinois are supposed to come up maybe next week too.
Yeah. And it sounds like on the East Coast, stuff is still very much kicking off and lots of opportunities over there. So very exciting for folks over there right now.
Yep. Well, let's get started. Do you have any news of the week, Priscilla?
Not much. We kind of talked about rain coming and precipitation having been on the East Coast, rain coming in the Northwest. This last weekend, they just wrapped up the 25th annual green race. Is a little bit different this year due to COVID and restrictions due to that. So they live streamed the race. It was kind of a pay-per-view scenario, so contribute a little bit and get to watch it live. There's lots of videos posted on various media outlets now that you can watch on YouTube, Instagram, or Facebook. But the top three winners was Dane Jackson at 402.3, Jeff Calhoun at 416, and Pat Keller at 418.1. So Dane set a new course record and got first place by quite a bit.
Wow. That's pretty fast. It would take me like 3 hours to do that course. With all the boat scouting and pulling over and talking, maybe portaging. I'd probably portage gorilla.
Oh, yeah.
What would take me 3+ hours, they do in 4 minutes.
Yeah, it's very impressive. And it was cool to watch the course with a little more water this year and seeing some of the different moves that some of the racers made. And yeah, I recommend watching the highlights or watching the full video, which I think a couple folks posted full videos from various parts in the course on YouTube at this point.
Did you watch the live feed?
I did not. We were out, I think we were mountain biking that day. Yeah. So we spent time outside.
It seemed like a cool thing to do to live stream a race. It's a bold move to do that in whitewater. And I hope people watched it to support what they're doing. Are they going to show, do you think, the live feed afterwards on, like, share it? Or is it just like you watched it and it's over?
I feel like I'd be kind of surprised if they didn't eventually just show the live feed to kind of build the stoke with the community. Yeah. It's pretty impressive, though, just thinking of, you know, whitewater races and where they're located, which generally doesn't have great cell phone service or internet. Yeah. So it's pretty impressive to be able to pull that off. It would certainly be pretty cool to be able to see more live feed races around the world. If people are able to figure that out.
I've been thinking it'd be fun to do in the hood because you get cell service in the hood, somehow figure out how to have a hood river race. Although the hood's class three, a lot of people might scoff because it's too easy to race, but it's still racing. It's good exercise, good to be out there. And I've been thinking about it'd be fun to do a hood race. It's like a hood rescue race. So you have to like go down some rapids, flip your boat, flip it back over, go down a little farther, hit a target with a throw bag. You know, I've been trying to think about like a hood rescue race. And then if it was live streamed so that the three people interested could watch it, it'd be even better.
Yeah, I like that idea a lot. Kind of like
be revolutionary.
I knew they'd do kind of an extreme race that involves a bunch of different aspects and bend. And I think Tom O'Keefe and some other friends competed, and it looked kind of similar to that, where there was a lot of interesting things they had to do in various aspects, and it looked really fun. So I think that kind of race would be really enjoyable to watch.
I think it'd be cool to even everybody out, because, you know, usually who wins races are people in the best physical shape, not necessarily the best boaters, or the best, or they're good boaters, but they're racers. They're not technically good boaters. They can't throw a throw bag, or they're not physically fit to do certain things. So to do it so it equals it out and makes it more competitive, I think would be really fun.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like how the King of the Rogue was, where it was like a relay race. And so you had to portage as a team, and you're kind of tired when you got back in your boat, and you had to switch crafts in between laps. And I thought that was really fun.
Yeah, I'm into that kind of thing. Cause I, you know, when I go race somewhere, I can pretty much tell who's going to beat me. Like, oh yeah, those guys train all the time. You know, they're in the better boat for racing. I don't want to buy a special race boat. I'm going to get spanked, but I'll try really hard. If there was some sort of like flip the boat halfway down, I feel like I'd have some little advantage for that. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I'm super slow when it comes to paddling racing, but I'd love to see like a portage race. I feel like I'd do pretty good in that.
That's called running. That's a running race.
Yeah. Well, did we have any other news of the week?
No, I want to go back to, I thought of one more thing on racing. I don't know if we're going to have a race season this year, which is a bummer because of COVID. We'll see what happens. It's hard to hold an event as an event organizer, especially volunteer. If it's a business doing it and your livelihood depends on it, you might be motivated. But if it's just a volunteer thing, it's easy to throw the towel in, which is a bummer. But one thing I've been thinking of is to have like an online race where there's a course and then everybody submits their GoPro video on the course. And then, you know, somebody puts it all together and declares a winner.
Yeah.
You know? Or maybe every team does the course and posts their video on their channel, and then we just all look at them and say, oh, this person's faster. The only tricky thing is somebody might speed theirs up by like 3%. So, you know.
Yeah, you'd have to have some way to check that.
You may not. You may just have to trust people. But it would. I think it'd be fun to, even if we don't have a wind race, be like, hey, everybody this week, post a video of your run from here to here, and we'll at the end, you know, compare race times just to the spirit of the event. So hopefully – I know Scott organizes that event every year. Hopefully, if he doesn't actually hold it, he may be interested in doing something like that.
Yeah.
Just sort of an online version.
I think that's a cool idea.
Oh. Sorry about that. I just wanted to add that before.
Yeah.
Then before we moved on.
Yeah. Cool. Well, should we move on to our main topic?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, before we do, let's talk about the Wyden bill coming out
really quick. Yeah. So details are forthcoming, but we understand that there will be the rollout of another set of wild and scenic proposals in Oregon. I think coming this month is the word. So we're keeping our eyes peeled and seeing when that's introduced, but it should be pretty exciting. There's a number of rivers that Zach and I have paddled and have advocated for protecting, particularly in the Illinois drainage area, that are hopefully going to be a part of that package. And it would be really exciting to see those areas protected finally.
Yeah, and it's statewide. It's been a huge project. You know, Senator Wyden asked for proposals from Oregonians. And I think a lot of us have forgotten about conservation because of, you know, the Trump administration. It's been hard to get anything done. And then on top of that, COVID, we're all just sort of worried about our own safety. And so I've kind of been on the conservation's been on the back burner for me. And I'm excited once this bill comes out to have something to work on again to try to do.
Yeah. I think it's an exciting prospect to be, working kind of proactively on some of these things versus feeling like we're on the defense for many things.
Yep. And one thing I like about the bill is, you know, Oregon has the most number of wild and scenic rivers by far, or segments of rivers. It's not the whole river. mm-hmm. but we're second in miles to Alaska. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure whatever Bill Wyden proposes is going to put us, he wants mileage. We're going to pass Alaska.
Yep. Yeah. He's pretty competitive, which is exciting. Just to see that kind of motivation when it comes to things we care about. Yeah. So pretty exciting. We'll keep our eyes open for any updates and see where it goes. And if you don't already, follow American Whitewater, because they will certainly be involved in advocating for that, and we'll be posting some stuff soon about it.
Priscilla, what's the best way to follow American Whitewater? Would it be like follow their Twitter, follow their Instagram, get on the email list? What's the best way?
Yeah, all those things. They're pretty active on Instagram. And I don't have Twitter, so I'm not sure about that. So they're probably also active on Twitter. I find most of what I follow is on Instagram. They also have their Facebook page where they often will post action alerts and that sort of thing. And if you're not on their mailing list, just go sign up for that, become a member, and then you'll get the magazine and the newsletter and all that, so you can be further updated and help support the work.
Yep. Cool.
Yeah. Well, our main topic today, we're going to talk about exploratory/adventure paddling, and not necessarily in the same vein that we may have talked about it before. We are going to kind of talk about some of the benefits of that type of paddling and how it can make you a more confident, competent paddler, as well as create this cool sense of exploration for some of the streams that aren't really well known. So for me, Jacob had this thought after having a conversation with someone talking about exploratory paddling, and they seemed a little worried about it, that it might be scary and a little bit daunting, and they weren't sure if they really wanted to get into it, but they were pretty excited about checking out some stuff that was more off the map. And so since Jacob helped get me really into that style of paddling, he was asking me, well, why do you like it? Why did you find that it was more rewarding than scary? And one of the things that I quickly found out is that you can be on a class 1-2 stream that doesn't have a lot of info about it and really develop your skill set, which then transfers over to harder rivers that may be on the map, and you just find yourself more comfortable in those scenarios. So for me, doing some of the easier runs that aren't even something that I would say, I'd call them novelty runs. Like, it was fun for me in the time, but it may have been like a low water class 1-2 stream with some wood and maybe one cool rapid. But I find myself, especially when you're doing these types of trips, you generally do them at lower water so that the pace is much slower, the hazards are much less. And I found myself actually enjoying figuring out how to navigate obstacles like wood, figuring out creating portage.
I'm the same way, but when I bring people along, they're not as enthusiastic about these things.
Yeah. It certainly takes being in the right mindset, I think. Especially when it comes to wood, if you're not used to it, we have this perception of it being really dangerous. And so in any scenario, if we're first encountering it, I think we have the tendency to kind of have an emotional reaction to it, even if it's not actually a hazard. So overcoming that can sometimes be a challenge. But then when you figure out, oh, this is really low consequence, very slow moving, you know, I can get my boat on top of a bunch of rocks, pop out, scout it, figure out if I can get around it. If not, I can figure out how to hike my boat around it, and that can be fun. And at the same time, you're seeing this river or this landscape that seems like not many people have seen it before, which personally I think is really rewarding. Even if it's not the most picturesque river you could ever find, it's just really cool to be able to see a landscape from river level. What about you, Zach?
I mean, I agree. I mean, that's why I paddle, because I'd like to go see new places. I mean, I started off as a backpacker and kind of got into boating from backpacking, and then saw boating as a way to see these canyons, you know, in a different way. Or like when you'd be backpacking on a ridge and look down, mm-hmm. wonder what's down there. It's a way to see what's down there.
Yeah.
Like where I started too, I used to go to Canyonlands National Park in Utah a lot and be hiking in the, you know, the backcountry there, trying to just find water, find a pothole of water just to like go a few more miles. If you couldn't find water, you'd just have to stop and turn back. Yeah. And then you'd get on these vistas and look down and you'd see all these rafts with, you know, people having fun, hooting, hollering, drinking beer. Not that you should drink beer and boat, but maybe I saw them at camp. I don't know. It just looked like boating is a way to like see places more comfortably too, mm-hmm. whether it's rafting or kayaking. So that's why I like doing exploratory runs and I like seeing new places. For me, I like the challenge of figuring out a river for the first time.
Yeah.
You know, getting above a rapid, and it's, to me, it's like a puzzle. I think it makes a lot of people nervous, and it should, it could, but even if it's a class two rapid, like you said, or, you know, something easy, I like figuring out the puzzle, or like the portage puzzle. How are we going to portage down this? It's super interesting to me. It's interesting because your topic was the topic, right? You suggested was expedition paddling to be a better paddler. Mm. I see it differently. I see it as like, be a better paddler so you can expedition paddle.
I think that's often the sentiment that people see. And I think it kind of requires breaking apart what the meaning behind words. So like expedition, mm-hmm. I think by default, people think extreme, like, you know, Corbulic and Stokesbury in Colombia doing mm-hmm. these crazy first ascents. I think I like to call it adventure paddling, because I think that more accurately describes the type of paddling that I think is so rewarding and what I think helps improve your paddling. And I guess the two bullet points that resonate most with me in terms of making you a better paddler is when you're in those scenarios, you're thinking, you become more acquainted with thinking about safety proactively. So for example, if you're the person leading the trip or the person with the stronger skill set, you're proactively thinking, what's the skill set of my group? Where are the hazards where someone might get into trouble? Where should I have a bag? Where should I be ready to grab someone in an eddy above something? It also, because you're getting out of your boat so much and scouting so much, I think that you learn to read water in a much more proficient way and to read different types of white water. So you're able to read, for example, if there's a piece of wood that's obstructing part of the river channel, but the rapid's still runnable, you're thinking, okay, what way is the water pushing? What eddy do I need to catch to be able to make this move around the wood? And what eddy do I need to catch to make sure I'm in a position to signal the people upstream of me or have a safety set for the people upstream of me? And I think that that's something that isn't really taught to beginner kayakers as much, because you're often following someone, getting verbal data, and you're not necessarily learning those skills on your own. But when you're doing it on a river where less is known about it and it requires you to figure it out on your own, whether you being the trip leader or you being a part of a group, it really hardens those skill sets, which then transfers into harder paddling on more difficult rivers, and you become a better asset to the people you paddle with.
Do you think it's something that can be taught or something that has to be just learned from experience and doing?
I think it's both. My experience is I had a desire, kind of like you, I always wanted to see the streams that weren't necessarily having trip reports and everything known about them. And so then I sought out people who also liked doing that. And so from observation, I learned what they did on the river. And then by asking questions and by being with those types of people, I then was taught some of those more latent skills. Like whenever you get out of your boat, always have your throw bag, because you never know what's going to happen. And that's something I learned through more exploration, adventure, kayaking. And that's then transferred over to, you know, everyday runs like on the White Salmon. that I'm super familiar with and might be prone to forgetting to bring my throw bag when I get out. Like I'm always having my, well, I sometimes forget, but
yeah, I mean, let's say you're in the White Salmon and everybody goes, you pull over to scout Houston. Would you remember to carry your throw bag then?
Yeah, definitely. And okay. I've seen a lot of people forget that. And
I forget.
Yeah. And not to say that I'm perfect, but it's in the back of my head just because that's been ingrained. Like even if it's a rapid, you've run 100 times, you never know when that weird thing's going to happen.
Yeah.
And then it just teaches you, like, if you're on a river for the first time, like, you know, season opener, you're thinking about, well, the conditions could be different from last year. Maybe there's some new hazards in the river. So you're proactively scouting, whether it be by your boat or getting out or kind of watching out for your group, because you have that mindset of doing trips on more adventurous rivers.
I mean, that's something I've found I do, even like I said, on especially season openers. When we did the first run of the year on Dita Tucker here in Hood River, I was nervous the whole time. It's class 3+, easy 4, but I know there's all these blind corners and there could be new wood around every corner. And so I noticed the people behind me were like not as looking out for that stuff, but that was like in the every corner, I'm just kind of looking over my shoulder, looking for eddies to catch in case there's something. Just from knowing that at any time it can happen, especially the first run of the year or after big flood events.
Yeah, definitely. And I don't think it's just an inherent skill set that you get by paddling well or paddling hard rivers.
Can you be taught that, or do you have to learn from making a mistake? Do you have to be on a river where it's almost, I kind of feel like you almost have to have learned it from the school of hard knocks a little bit to have it drilled in your head. Or like we can talk over like blind corners, you know, scat if you can't see around the corner, eddy out. Like we can talk about this to death, but you don't maybe really learn it until you make a mistake.
Yeah, I would probably agree with that. I think it goes back to like that generic saying about something negative weighs or has a larger impact on you than something positive, no matter, like, you know, for example, if you had a really good day at work and then someone's mean to you at the end of the day, you're going to remember that more than everything else that happened during the day. And so there is that too. But I think, and I've seen this in paddlers that have kind of learned how to paddle on more adventurous runs, they develop that skill set from doing that and experiencing it and not necessarily experiencing anything bad, but it's just, I'm trying to think of a good example. It's like someone who only does backcountry skiing is going to learn different things than someone that does resort skiing. But that doesn't mean that you can't do both.
Hey, Eric's joining in.
Oh, good.
Welcome to the show, Eric.
Hey. Great to show up.
So we're talking about expedition paddling, and we were just talking about, I want to ask Eric the question, if there's like all these skills in expedition paddling you learn, like to like grab your throw bag when you get out, to like be wary of blind corners so you don't run into a tree, you know, which trees maybe you're safe and unsafe. Out of all these skills, let's just say there's a bunch of skills. We should probably list them, but we're not. Are those things that you can teach, or you kind of have to learn them the hard way?
I mean, there are things that you didn't mention there that I would say probably a lot of it is learned experience, and maybe some of it's stuff you hear, but you kind of have to experience it, understand it. But the things that you stated there are both things that I think you can teach and learn on non-expedition type trips, right? Like on your backyard run, if you're getting out to scout something or safety, you should carry a throw bag with you. Like that should be a standard thing. I mean, hell, I learned that on the truss or, you know, any of those other kind of like back runs.
On that example I just gave Priscilla, Houston Falls. You go to scout Houston Falls. Do you carry your throw bag?
You scout Houston Falls?
Sometimes. Well, I mean, what if some people in the group want to scout it?
Sometimes Houston is really scary.
No, totally. Super scary.
Oh, geez. Your next run is not going to be pretty.
But I think what we are saying is like, if you're taking someone down, you get out, do you have your throw bag?
I don't trust on something easier.
Houston's a weird one. let's think we're like
Blossom,
Horseshoe, or like the East Fork of the Lewis, because I just watched a video of the East Fork of the Lewis. Something like that, I probably would carry a throw bag just because it's like habit. If I get out of my boat to go look at something, I'm almost always going to carry a throw bag, just habitually.
Is Horseshoe the first waterfall or the second waterfall?
Second one, I think.
Can you kind of at the end of one?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I didn't know that.
Well, if it's low enough, you can scout from like the bedrock in the middle of the river.
What's a throw bag going to help you? Because you're basically on the bedrock in the middle of the river.
Well, so yeah, the halyard, if you end up getting smushed into the right side where that's that kind of pillow rock in the corner, you could pull them out from the middle, which would actually be an easier throw than from river left if it's that low.
So for me, a reason I carry a throw bag if I'm scouting, and I would say this is true. I mean, Greenwall is probably more expeditionary, but the reason I would carry a throw bag when I'm scouting is like, what if somebody slips and falls while you're scouting and goes in the river? Or for somebody sure. comes yeah, by for sure. and chaos happens, you know, like while you're down there. Or
but what if it's a rapid where if they slip and they fall and they can swim it and it's fine? What I mean, that's like, do you then always carry a throw bag?
Nothing.
What? Yeah, but you know that every single time you get out of your boat. What?
You're a throw bag. Don't you carry – you're one of those waist belt throw bag guys, right?
I want to be a waist belt throw bag guy. I'm trying to be a waist belt throw bag.
Then you have it all the time.
I think –
No, kayaking, I'm not going to wear a waist belt for sure. And like guiding, I'm not going to probably wear one, although I should. I'm trying to make that a habit. I'm with you guys 100%. I just think it's not – like there's times when you're like, nah, this is like Blossom Bar. Are you going to carry a throw bag scouting Blossom Bar?
I mean, I think it's just a good habit to ingrain. I mean, maybe not because you're so far away. It's not going to do anything.
Exactly. So sometimes that's my point is like Blossom Bar. It's like, okay, it's useless to have one. Will you sometimes make a judgment call scouting where you're like, you know what? I don't really need it because what am I going to do with it?
Yeah. If you're scouting from really high up and there's no purpose. However, I would say when it comes to adventure paddling, if you're scouting from high up, having a throw bag can help you scout.
100%.
You're setting up a way to not do sketchy scrambles. The other thing that I thought about in our conversation is putting your throw bag in your boat in a way that you can easily access it. So putting it between your legs versus having it stashed way in the back of your boat. And that has certainly helped me be less forgetful to bring my throw bag whenever possible. It's just having it right there. I look at it when I pull my skirt off and I'm like, oh, I should have this with me.
I'm the same. Hey, this made me think of an aside. Let's say like they're rafting and your boat's kind of wrapped, right? You wrapped, you're on the rock. Does it make more sense for you to throw the throw bag from the rock to shore or from the shore to the rock?
I think having both as options is always great.
Is any one better than the other?
In my experience, which isn't super extensive, but it's extensive enough, I have found that it really probably comes down to the space that the person has up on the rock. Because to get a good long throw, you have to be able to kind of stand up, spread your legs, not feel like you're going to fall over when you toss. In an ideal world, there's a big rock and they can throw from there because the shore is a much bigger target than an individual rock out in the middle of the river with a raft on it. But if you don't have good platform to throw from, then that doesn't do you a whole lot of good. So it's sort of back to Priscilla's point, it's better to have all the options on the table.
Yeah. Okay, we just had this debate yesterday and it just came to my mind, which was better.
And depending on the circumstance, hell, I've even seen where like the person from the shore tries to throw it. You know, it goes out to an eddy and somebody just paddles down below and grabs it and brings it to shore and on small short rapids.
Oh yeah. I know what you're saying. Yeah. We were doing practice ones yesterday and we threw it from the boat to the shore and it went upstream like 3 feet and he just went up and grabbed it.
Yeah.
You know, it hadn't quite washed down yet. Anyway, sorry to interrupt. We just had this debate and it made me think about it.
Yeah. So the main thing we were talking about is, does adventure paddling, meaning it doesn't have to be expedition style or gnarly or hard in nature, but just something that has little information known about it, generally doing it at low water to figure it out, does that make you a better, well-rounded paddler than someone who does more of the traditional way of paddling, as you go through the progression of class 1 to 5, and you have someone often leading you down these runs, giving you verbal data, you're sometimes scouting stuff, where, you know, more adventure paddling is you're learning skills like, what eddy do I need to catch? What's the last eddy I can catch to scout this rapid? How do I navigate certain types of hazards? Where do I need to set up for safety for my group? Learning how to portage proficiently.
Those reading water. Being able to read water. Trying to decide if you need to scout or not.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, your premise is sort of like, does it make you a better paddler? I would argue that you have to be a better paddler. That you shouldn't be doing class 4 expedition boating if you're not a class 5 home run boater. And you shouldn't be doing class 3 expedition boating if you're not a class 4 home boater. Like home run boater, that those skill, if you're going to, like, you should be a better boater to go do expeditionary stuff. But I think it's also important in this conversation to say that a home run can be expedition feeling if you do it by yourself, the first, like, not by yourself, but with, like, the Trust is a very well-known run, and there's good documentation on it. You generally, the rapids are listed, but the first time you go down, you don't necessarily know what's around the corner. You know that the next rapid is such and such. You don't know if it's 10 feet or a mile or whatever. And so you can do a lot of runs that have beta out there on them. But if you do them with a group that nobody's ever done it, it feels very expeditionary, and you utilize a lot of the same skill sets, and is a good training ground for going and doing true expeditionary stuff.
I think that's a great point.
Yeah, I love that's one of my favorite things about boating is doing a trip for the first time. I don't care about being the first person to do a trip, but my favorite thing in boating is doing something new, scouting my way down a rapid, figuring it out. Like, even
that's,
if I know
that's exactly what I said earlier.
Yeah,
that's the best part of boating.
And that reminds me of when I was learning to paddle, and I feel like every weekend we'd be up at Aaron and Ben and Jeff's house, we'd be reading like AW or Oregon Kayaking and being like, what are we going to run? And then we'd like, you would know the runs, but none of us did. So we'd be getting out a ton and swimming and practicing rescue. And I guess mostly me swimming.
doing rescues, not practicing them.
Doing rescues. But I felt like I learned a ton because we were getting out pretty much every rapid, and you weren't just like verbal beta-ing us down. You're like, all right, East Fork Lewis, let's scout Sunset. All right, let's scout the next one. And that was a really rewarding experience for me. And I think that's why I became more interested in off the beaten path runs, because it wasn't so scary. And I think that maybe that culture is changed with the development of GoPro and just like unlimited resources. Like, you can literally watch, like, if you want to run the Little White and you're a good enough paddler, you can watch all the YouTube videos and GoPro point of view videos and potentially not have to get out as much as someone who would be figuring it out their first time, even with someone that knows the run really well.
I do think that's one thing that's been lost in sort of the era of the YouTube, especially on like the backyard runs, is, you know, back in the day, when I was doing first time mental health stuff, you know, like, you had Oregon Kayaking and, you know, like Pete Jarrett, all those guys, but it was all like, here's a written description with some photos.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all that was out there to go on. And so you knew that like Bob's Falls was coming or whatever, but you got there and you had to figure out how to run it. Mm-hmm. You hadn't seen a video of the line. You hadn't seen, like, watched 100 people's videos of how they did it. You'd get there and you'd be like, well, okay, I know people run this. Which way do you think we should go? And you'd figure it out. Mm-hmm. And that's the one thing I think has really been lost is in sort of the video stuff, is you get there and you've watched 50 videos of green wall and you know the 5 different ways that people run it, and you don't have to sit there and sort of solve the puzzle. And that's the one piece where it's like, now you really do have to go out and run sort of the really off the beaten path stuff to get sort of that true feeling of trying to put the puzzles together.
Yeah. And there's plenty of off the beaten path stuff though.
There is, there's tons. And even on the more popular runs, there's lots of small rapids that aren't the one, you know, that are still challenging enough that you can kind of do that activity without, you know, but they're not hard enough that anybody videos them. So
yeah. Yeah.
I put up a video of the Illinois one time. It was like start to finish the big rapids. And somebody on YouTube got really mad at me. He's like, okay, not everybody knows about it. You've ruined it for everybody. And so I think there is that point.
They don't have to watch it.
You've shared all the rapids with everybody. You don't have to watch it, but people do. Now the average person can watch all the rapids and the mystery has gone away. His point was the mystery of the Illinois has gone away because somebody can now just watch the video and kind of just write down notes and follow those lines. And it makes sense, but there's still tons and tons of runs out there like the Illinois. I mean, nothing's like the Illinois, but there's tons of places you can go boat and go have that feeling. I think, though, that the culture of kayaking, I get a feeling it's changed. It's more about, I feel, maybe you guys see differently, about like racing's kind of taken over a little bit and then getting really good at the best class five runs and just doing those over and over and over as like a lap. Like, let's go do a lap on this, a lap on that. And that a lot of kayakers aren't getting out and exploring off the beaten path stuff as much as they used to. Yeah. I feel like you just sort of go like do your backyard run to train, but every chance you had, you'd go off and do a new thing you've never done. Now it's like, let's just do the truss again and get dinner. Or if in California, let's go run like Giant Gap again and keep doing Giant Gap, keep doing upper like middle consumeness.
Water levels on runs, and then
try higher water levels. Bring more people down. Like me, now that I know it well, I'm going to bring these five people down and let's just keep repeating, or let's flash it. Let's see how fast we can do it, how few portages. So I think that the culture has changed to more doing laps than let's go out and use kayaking as a tool to explore.
I think a lot of it has to do with the volume of people who can now paddle. I think the community, you know, in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s was really small. And of course, technology made it like what Eric was saying, is there is limited information. So you still had to figure out these runs, even though, you know, a number of people had done it. Now we have tons of people who kayak, and it makes sense that not all of them would be interested in exploration paddling or adventure paddling in the same way that maybe like snow sports have progressed. Like, I think, yeah.
Well, there's probably multiple pieces to it. And one, there used to be a lot more sort of new runs, you know? I mean, you think about like the Knapp brothers and how, like, the number of first descents they were able to bag in like Southern Oregon, California, all of that, like back in the, 90s? That ability to sort of first descents isn't there anymore. The way it used to be, everything's been done, or most everything, like a lot of things have been done.
Yeah.
So I think there's that issue. And two, you know, with the sort of growth of the YouTube thing and everything else, like even if you go back a little while in sort of the kayak movie scene, the making of those movies funded kind of these big expeditions. And so everything we were watching was big expeditions, you know, with all the kind of Southern Oregon guys and that whole crew of people that went out and did all that stuff. And again, with sort of YouTube coming up, the like, what was the last time you purchased a 40-minute kayak movie? Right? Like,
oh, of course, that's over. Dead. Yeah, no,
and
that's
so,
dead.
But that's what funded a lot of that expeditionary boating. If you're a company producing or making it's cheaper to go out and just have somebody film their, like, if you're GoPro, why fund
it? No, I get it. Eric, I think
that you just have to go do the little white at 4 feet or 8 feet or whatever that was do these days.
Yeah.
That was a small subset of the boating population then that was funded by video.
It's what inspired the culture, right?
Yeah.
We're all watching and shooting these expeditions. So we're all inspired to go on expeditions. Now, all the media that we're consuming is people just like pounding the little white, doing tricks off Spirit. So what are we going to be inspired to do? What's driving the progression of the sport? It's not expedition anymore. It's rad tricks off giant waterfalls. which is batshit crazy these days, the stuff they're doing. Like, super rad.
Well, it's like I was just looking at I was trying to get a photo of Tokidi and then came across Korbelik's First Ascent, and it was like Outside Magazine, Men's Journal, some other news feature. It was like there was so much like actual media and printed publication and video and everything about it, and it was just like, holy smokes, like that would never, it would be like a blurb in Kayak Session Online if that happened nowadays, followed by High Water, Little White Laps, and the Green Race, you know?
Yeah. I mean, running waterfalls is now boring for me to watch because there's nothing else. There's been so much video of so many big, crazy things. It's hard to go bigger than what exists. Like back then, every few weeks, somebody even went bigger or did something crazier. At this point, I'm not going to be impressed. Like you can go over double Niagara back to back. And I'm like, I've seen some big stuff, you know, on YouTube before.
Yeah. It's like, there was a time where Metlako and Sahaley were like, you know, they were the world record. Yeah. And now we have Palouse and Puma and Alexandria Falls. Like, you know, you can only push that. Now we've moved over into freestyle and down river freestyle on those, you know, on those waterfalls and runs that used to be, if you just did them, that was impressive and newsworthy. So I think it's certainly a culture shift, and it's something that has to do with technology progression and as well as the sport progressing.
So our original question was, our original thing was, does expedition boating make you a better paddler? I think that, yeah, of course. Expedition paddling makes you a better paddler, but paddling makes you a better paddler too. And I think I see it as like, I paddle more after work now to be a better expedition paddler. I don't go expedition paddler to be a better after work paddler.
I guess I'll reframe it. We'll say adventure paddling again. And
adventure paddler.
That can mean doing a run where there's no information about it, or like what Eric was saying, doing a run where there's information about it, but you're figuring it out as a group. I think both of those in a category make you a better rounded paddler in terms of safety, reading water, just generally being an asset to the people that you're paddling with. And an example I'll bring up, I think I brought it up on a previous podcast, is an example that people referred to as the gorge syndrome, where you're just paddling the runs you know by heart. And what happened is, or how the story goes, is a number of very proficient class five plus paddlers had been paddling in the gorge for a long time. And then they went on an international trip and couldn't read class four rapids and were portaging stuff that was well below their ability level because they hadn't read whitewater in years. They'd just been doing the classics that they knew like the back of their hand. Now that doesn't mean that they're bad paddlers. Clearly they're class five plus paddlers, but translating that into a trip where you have to figure it out on your own, you're like, what? Why can you not read class four rapids anymore?
I was on a trip internationally where that happened, where I was with amazing paddlers, one of the best paddlers out there running like big waterfalls and stuff I would never do. And we were doing a big water, not very well known run, but we knew it was clean, like class three plus four, like 20,000 CFS. None of us had seen it. And he was scared because he just wasn't used to reading big water. And I was just shocked. I'm like, I was semi-comfortable. But to see somebody who in the gorge is just like a big waterfall dropper be nervous in big water was interesting to me.
Yeah. And I've seen the same thing with wood. Like, you know, someone can see wood in a class two rapid and they're a class four or five paddler. And, you know, they'll be portaging and I'll be like, oh, but there's just an eddy edge and like move around it.
When I moved here, I was that person. When I moved to Oregon, I was that. I'm like, no, there's wood on that run. We're just not going to do it. And everybody's like, no, it's fine. We can just get around it. I went and I was just so nervous of all these logs we were moving around until you realize like you have to start learning what's in and out of play. But my boating background was like wood danger, avoid at all costs, which is it's a good habit. It should be ingrained in us for a good reason. But to boat in Oregon, you have to start to learn like what is actually a threat or you'll never boat.
Yeah. Yeah. I, I think that Priscilla, the point you were making about like just reliving your backyard run versus trying different things, it sort of feels like a conversation around like gym climbing versus how you have all these really high-end competitive gym climbers who then don't translate their skills or can't translate their skills to actually climbing outside.
Yeah.
You know, and you hear about these like, what's the word I'm searching for? Like really prolific indoor competitive climbers, and they go outside and it's like their mind is blown. They don't know how to do it. They can't set trad. They can't, you know, like they can't do a 5.8 trad route, but they can climb like 5.14 indoor.
Yeah.
But maybe they don't care. Like maybe the gorge paddlers are happy just paddling the same 8 runs in the gorge, and they're like, let's go paddle, go to everybody's, you know, have fun. And maybe they don't want to travel internationally or have ambitions to do those trips.
Everyone needs to feel inclined to do adventure runs or exploratory expedition runs. That's the beauty of the sport. You can kind of pick what you want to do. If you want to paddle class 3 in an IK forever, you can do that. Like you can just have fun. You don't have to push your boundaries, but I found that I can have a lot of fun on low water class 3 runs that I don't know anything about in the same way that I have fun figuring out a new run in the Olympic Peninsula that has a bunch of information about it. It's like that same level of reward of just figuring something out and piecing together the puzzle.
I'm with you 100%.
Remember, there are people that don't get out of playboats. So,
and I don't know how to play boat. I'm sure I would have a ton of fun if I knew how to, and I'd probably do it more if I didn't live in a place where the water's frigid all the time. But yeah, I think that that's all interesting points. And I think it's important to say, like, you don't have to do these things, but if you're interested in stepping off the beaten path, there could be a lot of reward for doing it. And you don't have to push your paddling ability to be able to increase some of the other skill sets that are involved in being a well-rounded paddler.
Priscilla, going back to like my favorite is class 3, read and run, boat scouting, low water.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's so fun, but most people hate it. Like I'll go, let's go hike. Like there's the Eagle Creek that flows in the Clackamas. You can go up into the wilderness. You hike up the trail. It's beautiful up there. Mm-hmm. And then just bounce down in a ducky nonstop class 3 with the occasional wood portage. Mm-hmm. To me, that's heaven. I'm in a beautiful place. I don't mind beating into rocks, but I'll bring people on that kind of trip. And they're like, they hated the hike in. They're constantly getting stuck on rocks. It's frustrating. So I think that like that, I think there's a certain personality type that likes that kind of thing versus other people that just want to float a river and not bash into rocks or have to hike all their stuff to the put in.
I also think, Zach, that there might be, and I'm just going to toss this out there, there might be an age component to where where we are in life. Like my priorities used to be very different than they are now. Like I'm with you. I don't know about the low water bouncing my way down,
but
a good like class 3+, 4-minus nonstop run that I can scout, maybe with some expedition to get into it. Like yes, all day long. You know, I think about it in backcountry skiing context. Like I used to skin to go ski the gnarliest stuff I could find down. Now I'm like, I'm as into the uphill as I am the downhill in a lot of ways. Like I want to go have a big expedition, you know, exploration in the mountains and go see new stuff and ski different things. That's more important to me than going and doing like triple stage cliffs and all that kind of stuff. Like my interests have changed over time to the expedition and the adventure being a bigger part of it than the like immediate adrenaline pump of doing like the whatever the hell thing.
Yeah. And I've noticed that with really good pro paddlers too. I think there was a cool video that was put out where Galen, I can't pronounce his last name correctly, paddled an exploratory expedition run with Todd Wells. And he was just saying like, this is so cool. I'm so excited. And, you know, he's someone that's pushed the boundaries in kayaking a lot and got a lot of reward from doing something off the beaten path. And you sometimes see that progression with paddlers who have been competitive in slalom, then changed over to whitewater paddling, gotten really good and pushed boundaries of that. And then they're like, what's next? What's the new way I can challenge myself? How can I have the biggest day possible? And that involves, you know, finding new things or more remote things while also pushing the difficulty of the whitewater.
Let's wrap this up if you guys are cool with that. But with one final thought I was just having, if it's cool, if I like can move the discussion, if people want to do expedition style paddling, like whether it's a raft or a kayak, what's a good first couple of runs? Like, where's a couple places where it's like, hey, this is a cool place to go and sort of get off the beaten path. Like, do you guys have any suggestions on starting points?
I mean, I would say do kind of like what Eric was saying and what I was reminiscing about is do a run where there may be a lot of information known about it, but limit how much information you give yourself. So do a run that you know is good, but one that you have to figure out on your own and that's well within your skill set to do so. And see if you like it. If you hate it, then you probably don't want to do much more than that.
Like, what's an example? Like, what would be one?
I mean, if you're a solid class 4 boater and you've never done the Malala,
like,
you know, do the Malala and figure it out on your own. It's roadside, so you can leave anytime you want to, generally. You can scout rapids on the way up. There's some you can't. There's plenty of opportunity to eddy out, portage, scout, boat scout, practice all those skills in a really low consequence scenario.
Yeah, I was thinking the Upper Klamath.
Hmm?
I was thinking Upper Klamath.
It'd
be a tough one.
I think I always think of like Hagen Gorge or Hagen, whatever that is. Like, you know, it's sort of an expedition to find the river.
Mm-hmm.
and then it has a wilderness feel, but you're really not that far out. And you could do, you know, again, like you can go and find reports of that don't and not watch all the videos on all the difference in how to do everything. But
yeah.
And you can go out and actually scout rapids and figure it out. You can portage basically everything.
Yeah. I think that's a great example.
That one's if you're hard multi. Though. The Hagen's a difficult river. Like, it's not.
Well, yeah, you should. Yeah. I think the rule of thumb is choose a run that's below your paddling skill set, not pushing it, at a water level that has eddy still, isn't pushing the boundaries of water levels. I think what I like about the Hagen example too is it's a pretty short run, so you're not going to feel the urgency of time. So I think that's another important part of it is have the ability, like on the Malala, you can leave the river and get to the road. Hagen is a short enough run that if you get an appropriately early start, you're not going to be pushed for time and you're going to feel comfortable scouting, getting out, portaging, and whatever.
Cool. We guys want to wrap this up with gear of the week?
Sure.
the weekly part of the show where we always have to remember what our gear of the week is. I see Eric's looking around like, what do I got in here?
I know, now that I can see each other, see like everyone looking around their offices.
I'll start because I have one.
Sweet.
Mine's kind of a negative review. Big Agnes stuff, I don't know if you guys have Big Agnes stuff.
I do.
Mine keeps breaking. It just keeps, everything I have breaks. It's getting frustrating to me.
I have a sleeping bag, and I feel like it's an awesome sleeping bag.
Oh, man. I like their stuff.
Are we talking chairs? What are we talking?
Tents and pads.
Oh. I have heard their pads are not very long-lasting.
That's too bad.
No. Or they're tents. I'm constantly fixing them. And so hopefully they have other good stuff, but I'm kind of bummed on how much I'm fixing all their stuff.
I bought a couple of their really lightweight chairs last year, fold-up-y kind of things. And I bought 4 of them. One of them lasted 3 days before the bungee cord inside ripped in half. But I sent it back. They sent me a new one. And it's still holding strong. So it may have been an aberration, whatever. So far, everything else is tending to hold up. But
the bungees haven't been breaking. They've been just stretching like crazy. And so I've had to retie a lot of bungees, replace a lot of bungee cords and intense stakes, which I don't know. I think that's something that shouldn't happen. But anyway, that's my gear of the week. Be careful with Big Agnes pads and tents.
My gear is immersion research Dim Johns.
What?
I know. They are fleece-lined sweatpants, and they're awesome. I basically live in them all winter. And
Dim Johns?
Dim Johns.
All right, I'm going to look them up. IHAR has so much cool stuff. Like DEM, Dim Johns.
There you go. Oops. Screen share.
Dim Johns. All right, I'm going to look at them.
And it is pretty, I like about them too, is they're not so heavy that you can't wear them under your dry suit too. So if you just want to like go to the White Salmon and wear your sweatpants to the put-in, put your dry suit over the top of them, and then have sweatpants again when you're done without changing.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Wait, are these, they're fleece?
They're fleece on the inside, and I'm wearing mine right now, actually. I don't know. The outside is like, I don't know, high-end sweatpant material.
Oh, I'm getting some of these. It's Dim Johns, J-A-W-N-S even, of course.
Yeah.
Just like a White Salmon paddler would pronounce it or write it.
Dave Fusilli maybe had something to do with that name.
Yeah. This is a different language. They're developing a new language over there.
Is that, Pennsylvania boys.
Yeah.
So my gear of the week this week is Sturdy Pine bags.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's out of Salmon. So it's some river guide or former river guide. I don't really know. Someone in Salmon, Idaho is making these kind of badass mesh sort of river bags. And they've got ones that are sort of backpackish. They've got ones that are kind of like a tote bag. They've got duffel bags. And they're well-priced, and they're badass. Like, they're just really clever stuff you could just clip in your boat and, like, throw your kind of daily stuff in. Just really good stuff. And river guide, you know, river person, small town manufactured. So Sturdy Pine.
So I saw these a bunch this summer, Eric. I really want one. They're always sold out of what I want.
Which one do you want?
I want the big gear bag.
Yeah.
Just like the back, my like PFD dry suit that size has been continually sold out. But
well, shoot her an email and say, and you know,
I need
order
to.
It now, and you're probably getting it in 4 months.
Back order.
That's my fault. I don't mind waiting 4 months. They're really cool. I think the thing I like about it is it's just stuff with soul.
Yeah,
like the equipment hat, like it, you know, it just feels like it's a company with soul.
Yeah. Support small businesses.
S-O-U-L, not S-O-L-E, like they spell it in White Salmon.
Yeah, so Sturdy Pine bags.
Cool.
Support those rural Idahoans and their badass stuff. So there's a lot of people making stuff, like cool products coming out of the Salmon these days.
Yep.
You know, wintertime board river guides are coming up with some really cool stuff.
Yeah, like Kate, isn't she making spices out of grasshoppers?
Yes, that's my favorite one. Yeah, when I heard about this, I imagined that she was out in like fields collecting grasshoppers and then crushing them up and putting them in spices and selling it.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that she's sourcing the grasshopper from somewhere, which was kind of disappointing. But it's supposed to be really high in protein, super good for you. Like takes your salt, and all of a sudden it's like it's got your daily protein and your little bit of salt you put on something.
Yeah,
must be awesome.
I've eaten some grasshopper chips; they were surprisingly good.
Wow, grasshopper chips.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well.
Well, who wants to do the awkward ending? Mm-hmm. Eric, it's been a while. Throw it in there.
Zach just did it.
No, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it super awkward. So, yeah, thanks for joining us and stuff. And I guess we'll see you next time on the next episode. Flow down the river, taking my sweet time over the river.